Welcome everyone to today's Big Picture program. And today we were going to do something special and we're going to play a song by Don Ho. It's called Tiny Bubbles, but unfortunately we couldn't get the rights to it at the last minute. So instead, Jim is going to sing it for you.
You ready? Tiny bubbles in the wine make me happy, make me feel fine. Tiny bubbles make me warm all over with the feeling that I'm going to love you till the end of time. And that was Tiny Bubbles by Don Ho. But when we were talking about bubbles, I thought this would have been appropriate to lead into the broadcast. But unfortunately, folks, you had to listen to me read it.
And if you'd like some musical accompaniment, you can go ahead and look on YouTube, find Don Ho's Tiny Bubbles song and listen to it along with today's show. And that'll just create the nice ambiance of what we're going to be discussing, which is, of course, the fact that we are in the midst, as we believe, of a major bubble.
And we're calling our big picture today, Bubble Up, the Everything Everywhere Bubble. Just like there's a certain kind of sector or a business or an idea that captures the imagination in the market, like internet in the 90s. Today, it's AI. We're in AI stocks. And I still think, Chris, this has probably got a couple of years to run. At some point, we will be putting in protective puts when it gets crazy. And when it gets crazy, you're going to see, you know, think of what the stock market was like in 99, or think of what the stock market was like in 2000, when the stock market was up 60, 70% the year before, but in the first 3 months of 2000, the stock market was up 20% in just 3 months. We've seen that here just in the last couple of years. The other thing that we're doing on the bond market is we're not going out longer than 2 to 3 years, because on a 2 to 3 year bond, I know exactly what I'm going to get when the bond comes due. I know exactly what my interest is going to be, and we're using that. And then the other area is we're using precious metals. My goodness, look at what's happened to gold. Do you hear the media talking about gold prices have been above $2,000 an ounce, and they've been that way for 15 weeks. We almost hit 2,200 today. And crypto, and by the way, commodities are the cheapest that I've seen commodity prices in over 100 years of history. The other thing that we think we're going to see is high, and you've heard me pound the table on this, high dividend blue chip stocks, because they're being ignored. But think about now, Wall Street is pricing in one or two interest rate cuts coming this summer. Powell said they're on the way. Not yet, but they will be coming this year. When that happens, interest rates are going to go down on T-bills. They're going to go down on bonds, and you're going to see a scramble for yields. And that's when I think these high-paying dividend stocks are really going to shine. So what we're doing is we're using options. We're in AI. We're using dividend stocks, especially if they've been pounded, and we can pick them up at a cheap price. Because in a bubble like this, you don't really want to chase some of these high-priced stocks at 75 times earnings. You're safer off looking at value stocks that offer you a high dividend, selling at a low PE ratio, have a strong balance sheet. You've got a lot more protection, because those dividend stocks, that was one of the reasons we were up 8% in 2022 when the market was down 25 and 33%, because people were looking for safety during that period of time. So, Chris, the point of a bubble is, number one, a bubble will last longer than you can expect it to. And I think this is probably, I would say, the final stages of the bubble. We're probably in the last quarter of a football game here. It reminds me of where we were from the internet stocks in 1995 to the year 2000. I would equate where we are now is probably between 1997 and 1998. But you have to look at your investments differently. You have to be more active than you have. If you're in bonds, you have to be short-term and laddered. Look for things that are underpriced and protect the gains that you have. And that's how you navigate a bubble.
So that's what we're doing here at our company in terms of navigating this unfolding super bubble, which you believe may still have some time to go. You likened where we are today to about where we were around the 1997 to 1998 time period during the tech bubble. But even with that said, I think it is important to point out that regardless of where we are in this process from a timing standpoint, we are still exercising tight risk management and using a variety of strategies to lock in gains or minimize downside losses as we participate in this very strong move. So this is what you did, Jim, for clients during the tech bubble and also before the 2008 crash, which you had similarly warned about prior to their bursting, both on Financial Sense NewsHour and through a variety of articles that we had posted on financialsense.com. All of that is archived and historically available, and you are making a similar warning this time as well. The main point here, though, is if you are investing in these stocks or assets that are experiencing a bubble-like move, make sure you are managing your risk appropriately. So with that said, when it comes to the super bubble that you're discussing now, how did we get to where we are today?
This goes actually all the way back to the appointment of Alan Greenspan as head of the Federal Reserve. And in 1987, we had a stock market crash. We had a 10% market drop on the Friday before the crash, and then 23% drop on the day of the crash. And what happened is Greenspan came in and flooded the markets with money. And within a week, it was all over. We were back to the races again. He did it again in 1991 when he brought down the Fed funds rate and brought interest rates down from 10% down to the single digit, literally ending the era of double-digit interest returns. He did it again in 95. He did it again in 97 with the long-term capital management crisis. He did it again in 98 with basically the Russian debt default. He did it again in 99 with Y2K. And he did it again in 2000 to 2004 when the tech bubble crashed. So once again, it was the Fed coming in with what they call the Greenspan put or the Fed put with any chairman that is out there now. And we've seen this practice repeatedly. We saw it with Bernanke in 2013. We saw it in Powell in 2019 and 2020. So anytime there's a severe pullback in the market, the Fed comes in and floods the market with money. But this bubble really has its genesis going back to 2010. Now, remember what happened prior to 2010. We had the great financial crisis where basically the financial system was completely insolvent and the government had to come in, bail out the banks, bail out brokerage firms, and even insurance companies like AIG, the largest insurance company in the world. The government put in $200 billion to bail that company out. So what happened coming out of the financial crisis? The unemployment rate was in the double digits. So in 2010, Bernanke comes in and his policy, he takes over from Greenspan, and the economy was only growing at about 2%. The unemployment rate was at 9.5%. And Bernanke came in and says, we're going to try something novel. We're going to try quantitative easing. That's a fancy Fed talk for basically, we're going to print a ton of money. And that's all QE is. It's money printing, actually digital money printing, because they don't print the dollars. They just create them out of thin air on a digital transaction on the computer. And so the idea behind it is if we can lower interest rates and bring interest rates down and flood the market with money, it'll inflate asset prices. If asset prices are inflated, people will be wealthier. They'll have more money to spend. That will be more jobs. It'll be greater economic growth. Now, unfortunately for Bernanke, there was one Fed governor, Honig, who remembers the financial bubbles and the lessons learned in the financial crisis of 2007. So he was the one person voting no against the QE. Now, eventually they got him off the board. He retired and Bernanke went ahead with QE1, QE2, QE3, and he ushered in a period of 0% interest rates. Now think about that, folks, what that means. For 10 years, interest rates were kept at zero, even though the economy was growing, albeit at an anemic rate. And what 0% interest rates did, they distorted the whole financial system. Now, fast forward to 2020 with the pandemic and modern monetary theory, we now had fiscal policy in conjunction with monetary policy. going at the same time. We'll get to those numbers. But the difference this time and why you're seeing inflation is when the Fed was doing QE, the inflation was in the stock market, because money can go three ways. It can be kept in a mattress, as happened in early Germany in 1920 when the Bundesbank started inflating. Germans kept their money. But eventually, as that inflation increased, then you got money velocity and then you got the great inflation. So it can go into a mattress, or you just keep it in a bank account. You don't do anything with it. You can spend it, in which case it goes into the economy and inflates it. And the third option is financial assets. And so the QE that we saw in the last decade, the bulk of that inflation went into the financial markets. And that's why everybody would say, well, there's no inflation. Well, there was. It was just inflation of assets. And so with the pandemic, you now merged and you had the full impact of modern monetary theory, which will be with us for the rest of this decade, where you will have fiscal spending. I mean, if you heard the president's State of the Union speech last night, all kinds of massive new spending programs. I don't know where in the hell we're going to get the money. We'll actually have to print it because we don't have the money in terms of tax revenues. So that is really the origin of how this began. It was a change of philosophy in monetary policy, which was QE, and a change of fiscal policy, which was MMT.
Yeah, and just in case anyone hasn't heard MMT, we've discussed this modern monetary theory on our podcast for many years, of course, but it's basically an economic theory that asserts that governments with fiat currencies, as every country around the world has today, can issue money to fund spending without immediate concerns about deficits. So it's basically the ability to engage in deficit spending and do so without any real risk or harm, as long as you have the reserve currency, which the US dollar is the global reserve currency. The only major limitation to that is concerns regarding inflation. So as long as inflation is remaining low, you can continue, according to modern monetary theory, with this practice. And so, you know, as long as we see inflation remaining subdued, it's likely that fiscal policy will remain loose and we will see deficit spending continue as we have seen now since 2023, over $6 trillion. And as of fiscal year 2024, we're already over $2 trillion and on track to overtake the spending that we saw last year. And you can see that right off the fiscal data government website. If you just look at fiscal data, treasury.gov, it will show you that data there. So we're on track to spend more money this year than last year, and that was already a record amount. So that is modern monetary theory. And of course, that plays right into what we're discussing when it comes to bubble 3.0, as we're in the midst of today.
And once again, you mentioned it, Chris, the Achilles heel to modern monetary theory is inflation. So let's talk about how all of this came into being. Let's go back to 2007, 2008. The Fed increased its balance sheet from $800 billion. They increased it by $2 trillion to bail out all the banks. So that was the origination of the first real big money pump that we've seen. I mean, they did in 1 year what took them almost 100 years to do when the Fed was formed in 2013. So then, as I mentioned, in 2010, the economy was not growing as fast as it did in the previous decades, especially like the 90s when the economy was growing at over 3% a year. Productivity was 2.5%. Now we were talking about anemic economic growth of 2%, an unemployment rate of 9.5% in 2010, and productivity that had dropped about 1.5%. So Bernanke comes in with this novel theory. If we can pump up assets, it'll pump up the economy. Corporations will get richer. They'll invest in new plant and equipment, hire more workers. And so that was the launch of QE. We got QE 1, 2, 3, and then QE Infinity. Now, QE, once again, was designed with the specific goal of inflating the stock market and prices, which it did, because during the last decade, the S&P 500 doubled. Now, here's the important thing to understand where we are today. The Fed's balance sheet went from that $2 trillion mark in 2010 to its peak in April of 2022 of $9 trillion. And we'll come back to that $5 trillion increase. Currently now with quantitative tightening, as these bonds come due, they just simply disappear. The Fed doesn't roll them over or renew them. So right now, the Fed's balance sheet is roughly about $7.6 trillion. Also, deficit spending, and this is where modern monetary theory comes in, and it's why we're experiencing the inflation that came in with Trump and then accelerated under Biden. Deficit spending rose from an average of 3% of GDP to 14.9% of GDP in 2020. Currently, it's roughly about a little over 6%. And what happened as a result of this spending, the deficit went from 22.7 trillion to today of 34.5 trillion. And by the time we get to December, we'll be at 37 trillion in debt. So why did the economy do well in the last couple of years? Why haven't we had a recession with 5% increase in the Fed funds rate? Or a five full percentage point, because of $5 trillion of monetary stimulus and $12 trillion of fiscal stimulus. Add those two numbers together, that's $17 trillion. That's almost 80% of GDP. And that came in, once again, under modern monetary theory, where fiscal and monetary policy was pumping money into the economy.
Okay, Jim, you mentioned a key point back there, you know, in terms of keeping interest rates at zero for 10 years or so. How has this changed market structure, market dynamics as you see it today?
Well, there's two things. You would have to go back, Chris, to 1998 in an important safety mechanism that was put in during the Great Depression when banks went under because of speculation was something called Glass-Steagall. They basically went in and broke up the banks and they said, look, banks, we're going to keep the banks separate on the lending portion. The investment and broker-dealer brokerage part, we're going to split off. So J.P. Morgan it was a bank, but then there was J.P. Morgan Securities. They broke that up. They separated investment speculation from lending. That was done away in 1998. They removed Glass-Steagall, so now banks could speculate into risky assets, which, by the way, what did you see? That's how we got the great financial crisis, because they speculated in all these mortgages and these mortgage loans. And so that was one thing. And then now, when you have 0% interest rates, the last decade I would describe as a search for yield. And this affected so many people because it hurt savers. If you were a saver, you went from getting 5 or 6% to zero. If you were a retiree living off your savings, you got zero. If you were in an insurance company trying to match your liabilities, you got next to nothing. And if you were a defined benefit pension plan, as most of the government and state governments are, you were getting hardly anything on your bonds. So it really forced savers, retirees, insurance companies, and pension plans to go further out on the risk curve, because they were getting nothing on cash. The old saying, cash was trash. So it became cheaper to borrow and speculate. So if I'm a hedge fund and I'm only paying 0.5% to, let's say, borrow money, I can go out, heck, I could buy a dividend stock paying 4% and make money. I know people that refinanced their mortgages on their home, took out equity because they could get 2.5% to 3% mortgages, and they could go into dividend stocks paying 4 and 5%. So the result of this is the markets got riskier as the Fed basically QE kicked in. And what happened, it enabled people to go out and borrow money because it was next to nothing. People were borrowing to speculate, and people were borrowing basically to buy back stock, which we'll get to in a second. So let me give an example of what happened to debt. In 2010, government debt was $12.3 trillion. Today, it's $34.5 trillion. Government debt increased $22 trillion, 180%, and it has increased 50% since 2020. corporate debt went from $6.5 trillion to $13.6 trillion, an increase of $7 trillion, 110%. But the only moderation, Chris, in all of this has been consumers. And I think a lot of that had to reflect to what happened to a lot of consumers during the financial crisis, scared the heck out of them. A lot of people lost their homes when they had to refinance at higher rates. Consumer debt has really been accelerating probably in the last year or so with inflation. But consumer debt went from $14 trillion to $19. It was up 36%.
Jim, given all this debt that you mentioned, where did that money go to?
Well, it went to a number of places. Corporations used that money because they could finance their long-term debt. I mean, Apple was issuing bonds at 1%. They used that money to buy out their competitors, or simply they bought back stock. The biggest reason the stock market went up in the last decade had nothing to do with individual investors. 70 to 80% of the money flowing into the market was stock buybacks. It caused high-risk speculation. Hedge funds began to borrow at next to nothing and then leverage that into these high-risk trades, and private equity firms used it to buy out companies, load them with debt, flip them, and sell them. And Chris, that just didn't happen. Several companies I could think of were sold three different times to three different private equity firms, each time adding more debt. One company went from $400 million in debt. By the time they were stripped and finally went under, they were $3 billion in debt. It also went to keep zombie companies. And this is one of the things you'll have to look at in probably starting in 2025, because about a third of corporate debt that was refinanced at these low interest rates are going to be coming due from 2025 to 2028. So most corporate debt, Chris, never really gets paid off. Simply, like if I have a bond, let's say I have a $1 million bond, I'm paying 3% interest on it. It comes due in 2025. I'm not going to pay that bond off. I just simply call the investment banker. I issue a new bond for $1 million, pay off the old one, and roll the old bond into a new bond. So it's just basically rolling over. And they also came up with, just like they did during the financial crisis, where they came up with CMOs, those were collateralized mortgage obligations. It was basically, pardon the expression, crap mortgages that was sold to the public as being AAA. Well, they're doing the same thing today with what they call collateralized loan obligations. So these are kind of like private loans that are made to companies, packaged up in mortgage pools and sold to pensions, insurance companies. Same thing they were doing with mortgages in the 00 decade. They're doing the same thing in the last decade and now. So basically, Chris, we're repeating the same things that we did in the 00 decade. We're just doing them a little different. Instead of collateralized mortgages, we have collateralized loans.
So you're calling this the everything everywhere bubble. Where do you see these bubbles developing?
Biggest bubble out there is the bond market. And we'll talk about if you're in bonds, what you need to do. The stock market is in a bubble, but we're in the early stages. Stock buybacks are a bubble. Index funds are a bubble. Real estate is a bubble. Retirement plans are a bubble. And debt is a bubble. So there's basically seven bubbles that we see. Now, I want to make clear here, we identified the bubble in the internet stocks in 1998, and in December of 99, we sold 100% of our stocks. Nothing actually made sense. Companies were going public. They were doubling the day they went public. These were companies that had no sales, no profits. And the same thing in 2007 and 2008, real estate prices were just going bonkers. People were getting these bogus loans. We had ninja loans. No proof of income, or just a bunch of crazy type stuff. We're doing the same thing today with CLOs, where we've gone to covenant light. A lot of the loan restrictions that were put in place in corporate bonds to protect the bondholders have been stripped. So basically, the borrower has a lot more power now over the lenders because a lot of these restrictions have been removed.
So, Jim, as you mentioned, in that first place where you think we are seeing a bubble develop, and that's in the bond market, do you mind diving into that a little bit more in terms of how you see the bond market bubble developing?
Well, let's just take a look at where we've been in the last decade. we saw the lowest interest rates in 5,000 years of recorded history. Basically, if you go back, and I think Sidney Homer in his book, A History of Interest Rates, documented this. It's been updated lately, but basically, interest rates averaged between 3% and 6% during recorded history. In times of war, you would see bond rates get up to 6%. In normal times, they get back down to 3%. Well, we got down to 0%. And in many cases, like in Europe, we actually got to negative interest rates. And one would think, why would somebody pay, let's say, the government of France or Italy a negative interest rate to own the bonds? Well, think if you're a corporation like Apple, you have $200 billion in cash. You're not going to keep it in a local bank. So it was about the safest place that you could put large amounts of cash. It was mainly institutions that did that, that bought these bonds. So in essence, you were actually, the lender was paying the borrower interest to loan the borrower money. And we had this conveyor belt process. What happened when ZIRP took place, with ZIRP is zero interest rate policy, basically the Fed needed to create more bonds out there, create more debt. So we called this the conveyor belt, because with what the Fed did with hedge funds, they start selling bonds to hedge funds, because mainly right now the Treasury sells bonds to what we call primary government dealers. There are about 25 of them. These hedge funds could borrow money from a big bank, they could buy a Treasury bill, and then have a primary dealer sell the Treasury bill to the Fed for new cash. So that gave more cash to hedge funds. And once they got the money from selling these bonds, that cash didn't stay there because it was earning zero. It basically got flowing into the banking system and other places to invest. So as the Fed was buying all these bonds, flooding the money into the market, they had to create new bonds, hence more debt. And this is how they created it. So they created more debt, sold it, and then that money was put into the banking system. The banks got cash for the bonds. The hedge funds got cash for those bonds, and they turned it around. There's another thing we'll get into, not on today's program because it's too complex, but the basis trade. If you want to take a look at who's financing the debt, foreigners quit financing the debt in 2014. So they changed the money market and the laws for reserves for banks, and the banks went in and start financing the government's debt. Well, what happened? These banks now are sitting on almost $600 billion in losses on their treasuries. And this is something that we covered last week on the program with our technician. This is the first time 3 years in a row that we've seen back-to-back losses in treasuries. 3 years. We haven't seen that in 40 years. So anyway, this is one of the issues that we're going to have to be dealing with going forward. So if you take a look at this process, they were creating this environment, forcing this money into the system and forcing that money into speculation, because interest rates held at zero for an entire decade meant other interest rates were also low. I mean, the 10-year treasury got down to 0.5%. In fact, I can remember for a brief period of time, I think it was March of 2020, when the pandemic hit, corporate bonds just blew out, the spreads between treasuries and corporate bonds. And we loved it because we jumped on that opportunity and we were making 4% and 5% in high quality bonds like from pharmaceutical companies. But the Fed did something different in 2020. They came in and they got a mandate to start buying corporate bonds, not just treasuries. So within 6 weeks, the spread between corporates and treasuries narrowed, but the Fed expanded their mandate to not only buy treasuries, but to buy corporate bonds, just as in Japan, their central bank has bought their own treasuries. They've bought corporate bonds in Japan and they bought stocks. And I could see a day in this decade where if there is a problem in the markets, you could see the Fed come in, print money, and use that to buy corporate bonds, treasuries, as well as stocks. So the yield curve, here's another issue that we're dealing right now. The yield curve is inverted, meaning that short-term interest rates are paying a higher interest rate. And let me give you an example. A 10-year treasury is down to about 4%. A six-month treasury is at 5.3%. So the shorter-term end of the treasury market is paying a higher interest rate. Now, what does that mean to you as a bond investor? If you go long-term in a bond, you need to get compensated for the risk of holding something that doesn't mature for 10 years, 20 years, or 30 years, because you don't know what's going to happen in 10, 20, or 30 years. So it's called a term premium. In other words, as an investor, you are asking the market to provide you a higher interest rate than what you can get on a short-term bond because you're taking the added risk of owning something that is longer term. Well, right now, the yield curve is inverted. There is no term premium to taking the risk of owning long-term bonds, which is another reason we don't own long-term bonds. And if you're in individual bonds, I would stay in within like a 2 to 3 year period where you don't have the risk of interest rates change, like if the bond vigilantes show up and force the government to pay higher interest rates.
Okay, so I know you mentioned a number of bubbles already, and you're writing a book on all this, but let's focus in on the bubble you believe is brewing in the stock market.
Right now, the PE ratio on the S&P is 23. Traditionally, it's averaged about 18. The dividend yield is less than 1.4%. If you want to go to the NASDAQ, it's selling at 37 times earnings, and the tradition is we've averaged roughly about 29. And the dividend yield on NASDAQ is less than 3/4. Now, you think that's bad. Many of the Mag 7 stocks are carrying earnings multiples of 60 to 75 times earnings. And if you look at it, it reminds me very similar to what we saw during the internet bubble. You take one of the popular stocks, NVIDIA. NVIDIA had sales of $60 billion, but they have a market cap of $2.2 trillion. And so NVIDIA is selling at 37 times sales. Their PE ratio is just astronomical. And the other thing that this did too, is during this crazy period, we had SPACs. These were basically funds that would go out to the marketplace and say, we're going to raise $500 million and we're going to go out and buy some stuff. They didn't tell you what it was. But even had movie stars doing this. So these SPACs would raise this money and they would tell investors, we're going to use this money to go out and buy other companies. And all kidding aside, there was one SPAC that was issued for $2 million, not very much. But Chris, they bought a deli. You know what the deli sales were?
No, what?
14,000. So, I mean, then you had the meme stocks. Everybody remembers what happened with Robinhood traders, with GameStop to AMC, where they ran a stock that was like $2 or $3 up to $500. So this is the kind of crazy things that you're seeing. The next bubble that happened was stock buybacks. As I mentioned, from 2009 to 2019, 80% of the variation from the fundamentals on stocks and what was happening in the market, it wasn't earnings, it wasn't GDP growth that was driving the stock market, it was stock buybacks. And that accelerated under Trump. When Trump cut the tax rates on corporations from 35% to 21%, that tax law went into effect in 2018. So imagine if your taxes are cut by 60%, your earnings went up by almost 60%. So all these companies had these incredible earnings in 2018 and 19 and 20 because of these tax cuts. And the idea was they hoped that the money would come back here and they would use the tax savings to build factories here. But here's the problem that governments don't understand. A company is not going to build a factory unless the marketing department is saying, hey, we've got huge demands for our product and we can't keep up with our current production to meet that demand. That would be reason to build another factory. If you don't have that demand, because remember, the economy during this whole period was growing anemically. It was subpar. Instead of 3.5% economic growth, we only got 2%. So because of that, companies used that money to buy back their stock. And so we saw trillion and a half dollar stock buybacks because the individual investor was pretty much out of the stock market in the last decade. They've come back in since COVID. So the biggest buybacks were with some of the big mag stocks. And there's two reasons these mag stocks are worth $3 trillion, $2 trillion. Apple alone, from 2015 to 2024, Apple has bought back $600 billion of their own stock. Now, think of what that's doing. Buying that much of their stock back is driving the price up. As the price gets driven up, it occupies a higher percentage in the index itself. So like we say, almost 32 cents now out of every dollar that goes into an S&P index fund is going to go into those seven stocks. So Apple was buying its stock back, driving the price up. And then on top of that, as it occupied a larger percentage within the index, as money came into the index, it was also driving that stock back up. So here's something that we're going to have to think about. In 2026, Trump tax cuts expire, tax rates go back up to 35%. Now, there's a compromise. Biden wants to raise the tax rate from 21% to 28%. But if you talk about going from, let's say, 21 to 28, you're talking about almost a 33% increase in tax rates, and that's going to affect corporate profits going forward and from 2026 on. And also, the Biden administration added a penalty of about 2% tax on stock buybacks. So now, the next bubble that we talked about is index funds. And you have to understand with an index fund, there is no analysis, there is no evaluation. They just buy what is in the index. This is passive investing. And for the last 15 years, the dominant money flowing into the stock market has not gone into active funds. It's gone into index funds, almost by a 3-to-1, 4-to-1 margin. And index funds basically is brainless investing. It makes expensive stocks more expensive. A index fund does not say, I'm not going to pay 75 times earnings for NVIDIA. If NVIDIA is in the index, they simply buy it. If Microsoft is selling at 40 times earnings, they simply buy it. They're price insensitive, regardless of how inflated the stocks are. But here's something you have to keep in mind with an index fund. It works in reverse when you get into a downturn. And that's exactly what you saw in 2022. The Mag 7 stocks lost anywhere from 40 to 60%. Amazon lost 60% of its market value in 2022. Microsoft lost 40%. Google lost 50%. So as money comes out of an index fund, 30% of it goes to selling off those index stocks that carry the largest weight. And that's why the Mag 7 got clobbered and killed in 2022, and that's what will happen to them again.
Where do real estate and home prices fit into this?
Well, Chris, I mean, let's talk about our hometown. I mean, you've got in middle-class neighborhoods here, the typical home is going for $2 million. Now, I'm not talking about a McMansion. I'm talking about a house that's anywhere from 2,000 square feet to 2,400 or maybe 2,800 square feet. It's like that in New York and other major metropolitan areas. They're just simply no longer affordable. The affordability index is the worst it's been that we've seen in decades. It's a combination of rising prices and rising mortgages. Mortgages have gone from 3 to 7%. San Diego, the average price of a home in San Diego, these are starter homes, are $1 million+. The nicer areas are $2 million. And the custom areas are $5 million+. Most millennials cannot afford to buy a home. There's a lot of stories. The Journal has been doing it about this. There was a story about a gal that's working in Silicon Valley. She's making $132,000 a year. She had to move back to live in her parents. She couldn't afford rent, and she couldn't afford a house. And so that's one reason why you're seeing a shortage of supply. But eventually, this too will change. And then the final bubble, two bubbles I want to talk about briefly here are pension plans. And this really applies to people that work for the state or for cities or the federal government. You have something called a defined benefit pension plan. And what that means is you work so many years, and let's say your salary is $100,000. You retire after 30 years, and you're going to get 80 to 90% of your pension for the rest of your life based on this defined benefit. Well, what the states have to do, the federal government is a little different. They don't put money aside, they just print it. But the states have to put money aside in their pension funds to fund that retirement. Well, the problem is when we got to 0% interest rates, as we did in the last decade, how is a pension fund that needs to earn between 7 and 8% a year on its investments, how are they going to do that when bonds are only paying 1 and 2%, or maybe best 3%? So it forced a lot of these pension funds to go out on the risk curve. And so most of your state pension funds are underfunded today, just as the government is underfunded. So, and also corporations, Chris, basically, they shifted from defined benefit pension plans in the latter part of the 70s and 80s to something called defined contribution plans. And that's basically your 401k plan. So the company isn't on the hook to fund your pension. Your pension, when you retire, is going to be simply what you put in your 401k plan when you retire and whatever interest income that you can earn on that. That's not the case with states and cities and the federal government. They have defined benefit pension plans that require 7 to 8% returns. So a lot of these pension funds have had to go into the stock market. They've had to go into junk bonds. They've had to go into private equity, collateralized loan obligations, because it was a scramble and a search for yield, because unless they made that 7 or 8%, they were going to have unfunded pension plans that would create a problem because they would not be able to meet their pension obligations. And then once again, the last bubble is debt. And we're seeing it rise all across the board. And the real big issue you have to be in keep in mind here, in 2026 to 2028, probably a third of that corporate debt is going to be coming due, and it's going to have to be rolled over at much higher interest rates. And that's going to affect a lot of these zombie companies. Government will not have a problem, because I predict by the time we get to 2026 to 2028, the government will be using the Fed to monetize its debt, and they're going to exert something called yield curve control, where they'll print money, have the Fed print money, go out on the long end of the curve and buy those bonds to drive the interest rates down, just like Bernanke did in the last decade.
So, Jim, we discussed earlier what we're doing here at Financial Sense Wealth Management in terms of navigating this bubble. You covered the reasons why this is happening, especially when we think of the implementation of modern monetary theory and the trillions of dollars that are continually being spent each year into the markets and the economy. This is feeding liquidity into all these different areas that you covered and discussed today. Hopefully, our listeners came away with a better understanding of the big picture, as we call this segment of our show. As we close, boil all this down for us. What's the key message here from an investment standpoint that you'd like to leave with our listeners today?
So the point of a bubble is, number one, a bubble will last longer than you can expect it to. It reminds me of where we were from the internet stocks in 1995 to the year 2000. I would equate where we are now is probably between 1997 and 1998. But you have to look at your investments differently. You have to be more active than you have. If you're in bonds, you have to be short-term and laddered. Look for things that are underpriced and protect the gains that you have. And that's how you navigate a bubble.
Our show today is brought to you by Financial Sense Wealth Management, named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. If you have any questions about our asset management or financial planning services, feel free to click where it says contact us on financialsensewealth.com, or you can always call us directly at 888-486-3939.
In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Sheridan and myself, we want to wish you a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.